This is Eleanor Swent, continuing the interview with Vincent Perry on March 8th, 1990. Wanted to ask you a little bit about your living arrangements at Cananea then, and how did you get there? And you weren't flying back and forth between Cananea and Butte in those days.
No, in those days you took the train, and you went directly to Los Angeles from Butte, from Los Angeles to Bisbee Junction. At Bisbee Junction, you had to make arrangements to have a car and to drive through the international port of Naco into Cananea.
Company housing?
We had good company housing. It was not the most elaborate in the world, but it was typical of company housing. And we had a nice house out on what we called the flat, within about 5 minutes of the number one tee of the golf course, so that if geology had completely overwhelmed and exhausted me, I was always able, after 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, to go down and play a round of golf.
Did your wife enjoy golf?
Yes, she played golf. And we had a very lovely criada there that helped out with the family. And we had many friends. Like typical foreign mining camp, there was a lot of social activity going on among a small group of the gringos, and we had fine parties and get-togethers on weekends, trips down into southern Sonora, and picnics, delightful living.
Any association with Mexicans socially?
Yes, of course, there was. We had some very close Mexican friends. Some of the staff members of the Cananea Company were married to Mexican women, and there was a very close interrelationship between the American and the Mexican community.
Were there Mexican staff members?
There were staff. Yes, there were. Mm-hmm. Yes. So. But it was definitely an American staff. That is, the Mexicans were trying to become Americanized. Mm-hmm. It was not the other way around, and this, of course, was the developing cloud that culminated later on in the problems of nationalization and the troubles in Mexico that ended with Cananea, for example, being taken over and nationalized by the Mexican government. But while I was there, it was the best of all worlds. We had a very definite social relationship with Mexicans. We had many close and delightful friends among the Mexican community. And there were highly competent Mexicans all through our organization. One of my finest geologists was Ruben Velasco, who was a Mexican citizen and was a great contributor to the geological efforts in Cananea.
Where had he trained?
He had trained at the University of Arizona, graduate mining engineer from the University of Arizona. Later, he became chief geologist at Cananea, and after the Mexicanization of the company, he retired and then became professor of geology at the University of Sonora in Hermosillo, and he still occupies that post today. He's one of the senior members of the geological fraternity in Mexico. There were other fine Mexican geologists that we had. Ordóñez was one of them, and there were others who have either continued on in Cananea or have moved to other positions in the mining industry in Mexico.
What about medical care?
We had a good hospital at Cananea, headed by Dr. Hoagland, who was a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, and had early experience in Mexico during revolutionary times. He was the doctor at Minas Prietas during the days when Pancho Villa was rampant in Sonora, and had many stories to tell about the conflicts and problems that resulted from warfare by Villa. But he survived through the whole thing. Yes, they were, and he survived all of that, and was named when peace was finally established under Caius in Mexico in the 20s. He was hired by the Cananea Company to be the chief surgeon, and he was largely responsible for building up a first-class hospital with his background education from Pennsylvania, one of the outstanding medical schools of the country, of the United States. He was well qualified to do the job. We had American nurses down there that he had selected and were quite competent.
Your baby, you said, was born in Inspiration.
Yes, at that time we hadn't appreciated the fact that Dr. Hoagland was such a fine doctor. We had just met him a month or two before, and both my wife and I agreed that we didn't want to take any chances with the uncertainties of medical practice in Mexico, and since it was convenient for me to be at Inspiration to do some of a special job that the company wanted done at that time, Inspiration being a subsidiary of Anaconda, we went up there a month before the due date of arrival for our child, and the baby was born at the Inspiration Hospital. However, in retrospect, I can say that the kind of medical attention we got at Inspiration was far from less in quality than what we probably would have received from our staff at Cananea. But that was a tragic mistake which we made because of ignorance. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think it's an example of the kind of intolerance that sometimes comes from the fact that you don't really know the facts, and we just equated medicine in Mexico with something coming out of the Dark Ages, and we didn't want to have any part of it. And this was a mistake. We would have been much better off if we had stayed at Cananea and had our baby there than if we had going to a mining camp in the United States that simply didn't offer the facilities which were available at our own back door.
You might want to say something, because I think it is pertinent later in Chile also, about the social life in the mining camps, the drinking and the hazards thereof, perhaps, joys and...
Well, that would be quite, that's quite a subject.
Well, I think it's worth touching on, because, of course, right now, drinking is becoming out of fashion, I think, in lots of ways, but you went there in the flaming 20s, the late 20s.
Yes, and we went when Prohibition was rampant in the United States. And there were all sorts of abuses that stemmed directly from the Volstead Act. I went down to Cananea with a little idea about social activities abroad. Fun times in Butte were certainly good ones. We did really very little excessive drinking. I suppose there were times when somebody had too much to drink, but generally the parties were pretty orderly, and we had a lot of fun in Butte. We arrived.
What did you drink?
Well, I suppose we thought most of it was bathtub gin.
Gin.
That was the basic drink.
Did you mix it with something?
Oh, usually mixed it with fruit juice.
Uh-huh.
No, no. I was in Cananea probably several months before I'd had a drink. I remember the first real party we attended after my wife had recovered from her troubles following the birth of our baby Pat, and had come back to Cananea with me. There was a party given by the Stites family, who were neighbors of ours, and I remember at the time I was surprised to find that evidence of some real intoxication on the part of people that I didn't think ever took a drink. Maybe that was the reason they weren't used to drinking.
What did they drink in Mexico? Was Mexican beer available?
Mexican beer was very popular, and of course they drank tequila too.
Mm-hmm.
But beer was a very popular drink. But I didn't find that the drinking was done in excess. There were times when people had too much to drink, but generally it'd be on some very special occasion, like an AIME meeting over in Tucson, where there was a real festive mood, and there was sort of an escape atmosphere, getting out of your inbred surroundings and getting out across the international border to the United States. That alone was a cause for celebration, and very often somebody would have too much to drink. But certainly there was no alcoholism that I know of in Canada.
Wasn't a problem with the wives?
No, not at all. The wives generally set a very high standard in Cananea. It was, I thought it was in many ways an ideal mining camp. A lot of the things that I'd read about that happened in mining camps didn't happen in Cananea. We had one example of a young lady, Helen Taylor, who was a close friend of ours in Butte. She was a girl from New Jersey, a graduate of Wellesley, and she married Al Taylor, who was a geologist from Stanford University, and they were very active socially in Butte. And Al was given the job of organizing a geological department for Anaconda at Chuquicamata about the same time I was assigned to the job at Cananea. In later years, when I saw Al, he asked me if I had seen the book that his wife had written. I hadn't, and so he gave me a copy. And in the book, Helen Taylor describes in somewhat startling detail some of the parties that went on in the American colony at Chuquicamata. And it was kind of a shocker to me. I'm still not sure that Helen didn't exaggerate a bit, because that gave a little more color to her story. However,
we've all heard horror stories.
Well, Helen Taylor tried to put it all in black and white. She wrote a book about it. Yeah, and of course they left Chuquicamata and came up to the States, and Al eventually had his own consulting mining practice and did a lot of work in Montana because of his knowledge of Montana mining properties generally, and lived in Phillipsburg, Montana. Mm-hmm. And Helen and Al remained close friends of ours until later years, when of course they're both dead now. It was just an example of how sometimes stories are exaggerated. Yeah. Because their efforts to put them in paper are exploited, I suppose.
What did the women do for amusement in Cananea? Do you know?
Well, there were several women that played excellent golf, and we had a very fine golf course. And the women did a lot of golfing, and of course there was the usual rounds of bridge, that sort of thing. And some of them did a lot of good work around the hospital and helped generally in the community. It was Cananea had a really first-class group of mining people. They were recruited from not only from Butte but from all over the country, and that cross-pollinization from different parts of the world produced a very healthy social atmosphere.
That was another question I had. When you hired young assistants, did you go through Butte on this?
We usually did, yes. Could I get
that? Do you want to be unplugged a minute? Right, of course.
So those were good times to look back on.
Hmm? They were times that I can't believe could have happened. They were so good. We were there 10 full happy years in Cananea, and the life there was one of hard work and lots of good hard play in a ideal setting. You know, Cananea is beautifully situated. It's part of the southeasterly continuation of the basin range topography. You have the San Jose Mountains rising up to the east, the Ajos to the southeast, the Cananea Mountains and its extension, the Mariquita Mountain to the northwest, and the Huachuca Mountains to the north and west. And yet, the between them extended this great, somewhat dissected plain, perhaps 30
there.
Or 40 miles across, that gave a sense of openness. The elevation at 5,000 feet was the environment for an excellent climate, moderate temperatures in the summer, beautiful falls, a mild winter, and gorgeous spring, so that from the standpoint of anyone interested particularly in geology and getting out and mapping and working outdoors, it was an ideal environment. I remember Paul Billingsley coming down. Paul was Anaconda's chief geologist at Salt Lake City at that time, and telling me what a lucky fellow I was to be working in such a place. And I remember his description of those mountains and the great plains out that we looked out from our front porch, and said these mountains are like great battleships anchored in a sea of desert wash. And I thought he described it beautifully. And of course the social life revolved around that golf course and the get-togethers in the evening, when bridge would be the principal distraction, and also good conversation, and the ability to get in an automobile and go out across the line and be in a in the home country of the United States within an hour of and a half of your foreign home was a unique situation for us lucky people who happened to be assigned to the Cananea job.
What did you read? Did you take papers or magazines?
We read mostly the standard books of the time. We'd use the Bisbee Library for access to the available literature. Newspapers were rather scarce. We did try to get the Sunday Los Angeles Times, but sometimes it was delivered and sometimes it wasn't. But that didn't seem to bother us very much.
Radio? Did you?
We had fair radio reception. It came in from Bisbee, and but it wasn't, of course, anything like the kind of reception you get today.
Well, you were much more cut off.
Yes, we were more cut off.
Movies? Were there movies?
There was a Mexican movie house, and we I doubt that I attended it more than twice during the 10 years I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And, simply something, if we wanted to go to a good movie, it was advertised in Bisbee, and we made a special trip over to Bisbee to see the movie, and then would drive back late at night. But Bisbee was close enough so that it provided access, provided there was something really worth seeing. Otherwise, we were rather isolated
on our own.
Yeah. But an exceptional group of people that happened to be located in Cananea in those days, and I recall Reno Sales coming down on one of his periodic visits to check up on the geological work, and sitting on the top of one of the Cananea mountain ridges and looking out over that expanse around us, 30 to 50 miles in every direction of the compass, and saying, "Vin, Vin, I would say out of 10,000 mining geologists in the business today, you're probably the luckiest to have landed a job here." So that created a lot of happiness in our life and in our family relations. We had a month's vacation every year that where we could go out, and we usually headed out to the coast and landed in La Jolla, where we could enjoy the beach, and or Santa Monica, usually in Southern California, and occasionally we'd get up to see my sisters in Berkeley, or later in San Francisco, where they settled and had their homes.
Did the depression affect? Anaconda.
It affected Anaconda drastically, but at the same time, God again was good to us, because here was this tremendous high-grade ore body which was discovered just before the Depression started, so that Cananea was in a unique situation, and Anaconda was foresighted enough to move in just before the Depression and get complete control of a rich source of copper. And there was a long period when the price of copper more or less bottomed at 5 to 6 cents a pound, and yet Cananea was able to show a profit even during those times. And it was one of the two reasons why Anaconda survived the Depression. Butte was losing money. They were having a terrible time with their operations there. The fabricating plants were losing money. Chuquicamata, which had just been acquired, was a source of income even at low copper prices. And Cananea, with this bonanza ore body, was helping to keep Anaconda afloat. If it hadn't been for Chuquicamata and Cananea, Anaconda probably would have been in bankruptcy. As a matter of fact, there's stories told about how Mr. Cornelius F. Kelly, the chairman of the board, went to the Chase Manhattan Bank and said, "These are the facts, gentlemen. We are unable to pay some of our bills. We do have producing mines at Cananea and Chuquicamata that are able to make copper at 5 cents a pound. Do you want to take over the operation, or shall we continue to run it?"
Mm.
And the banks wisely decided that they'd better leave it in the hands of mining people who knew how to run mines, which is unlike the kind of thing that occurred in much more recent times, when banks have moved in and or greedy investors have tried to capitalize upon situations where management temporarily has been unable to maintain a profitable posture.
So you were virtually untouched then personally by the...
Yes, of course, we financially, our salaries were cut in half. I remember that very vividly, yes. But because we were living in Mexico and costs were low, it didn't hurt us too much. We were able to survive. Mm-hmm. And
how much were you making at that time?
I was making $500 a month, and my salary was cut to $250.
When was this?
At the start of the Depression, 1931.
Just across the board?
Across the board, yeah. Everybody was cut. But we accepted that. We were glad to have jobs.
Yes.
We knew that other people, I suppose one of the reasons that we didn't panic under those conditions was the fact that Phelps Dodge across the border at Bisbee and Ajo and Morenci was having a terrible time, and they were laying off engineers right now, as well as curtailing their actual operations. And we felt we were very fortunate to have a mine that was producing at 100% capacity, even though we had to take cuts in pay.
But you could manage on $250 a month with a wife and a child. That's
yes, mm-hmm. Yes, very. We lived a very satisfactory life, mm-hmm. And
hard to believe now.
It's hard to believe, but in those days, $250 in Mexico went a long ways.
Yes.
And
yes. What was the exchange? Do you remember?
I believe it was 2-for-1, uh-huh. At that time.
And you were paid in?
We were paid in dollars.
Deposited in the States?
Deposited in the States, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And of course you didn't pay a lot of tax.
And we didn't pay any tax in the United States.
No.
We were not subject to, and Mexican taxes were extremely low. I don't mm-hmm. remember the exact amount, but there was practically no tax in Mexico.
Mm.
So when you get that sort of money and are not subjected to a lot of taxation, why, it does very nicely.
And your house was provided?
And I think we paid a nominal rent. I believe it was 20 pesos a month for our house. And food was very cheap. Of course, we didn't have a wide assortment to choose from, but the Mexican poultry and meat was a bargain. I remember we'd get a tenderloin of beef for 2 pesos, the whole tenderloin. And we could put that in, we had a refrigerator, and we could put that in the ice box and live off that for a week or 2 weeks.
Uh-huh.
So those things made a big difference.
We didn't have to buy a lot of fancy clothes to go to work.
When we didn't have any fancy clothes, we had our party suit, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
There were no fancy clothes.
No.
It was a good life. It was certainly a wonderful life.
What did you do about schools and churches and that sort of thing?
Well, when we first went there, there was a, of course, the Catholic Church had been banned in Mexico, and informal services were conducted by Mrs. Wiswell, who was the widow of Colonel Green, the original settler and founder of Cananea, a big cattleman. And she lived there at the, in the home that they had built in the early days in Cananea. And she was a loyal Catholic, and she tried to conduct a prayer service every Sunday, and we would attend that. The restrictions on the church were lifted sometime during the 30s, and I don't know exactly when, but the Protestant community was served again by local people. There was a very fine neighbor of ours, Helen Keller, Marion Keller, who conducted services in the Methodist Church and had a Sunday school there, and our daughter actually attended Sunday school under her guidance in the Methodist Church. And we found that that sort of touch with religion was helpful, and we did our best to make up for it with more formal services when we would take our vacations out in the United States where there was religious freedom.
This is something, this period in Mexico was a very interesting
It time. Was, yes, yeah. And of course, just about the time we left, the church was recognized in Mexico, and the old cathedral there was renovated, and when I made periodic trips back to Cananea, it was pleasant to see the services, masses at Sunday practiced. As a matter of fact, my last visit to Cananea in 1989, I was really surprised to attend a mass that where you couldn't get in the church. It was, of course, all the congregation was all Mexican, but the religious fervor of the community, I thought, had revived as much as you could expect any place that was inherently a Catholic dominated society.
Now, I did want to ask also about your diamond drilling. Did Anaconda do their own, or did they contract?
No, we contracted the drilling. On our first contractor was Jimmy Valenzano. Jimmy was a product of Butte. He was an Italian immigrant who went to Butte and started there as a diamond driller for the company, and then moved to fairer climes down in Bisbee and became a driller for Phelps Dodge. Anaconda made a contract with him about the time I arrived in Cananea, and he did the first drilling I recommended after my early studies of the Cananea geology and my recommendations for exploration. Jimmy was highly competent. We had very good results, pardon me.
So you were just saying that you got excellent results from Valenzano.
And during the time I was at Cananea, he continued to be our diamond driller. Later on, I believe Ted Dodge took over the drilling at Cananea, at least did some of it, and how much he did, I don't know. But that was after my active days directing the Cananea exploration.
Interesting that the companies contracted out this.
Yes, but it diamond drilling lends itself to contracting. It's it seems to me that you get better results contracting than you do by making it a company operation. And it's a competitive field where you can pick and choose the best help. And certainly we had that in Valenzano, and I think later in Ted Dodge's work. Drilling generally in the Southwest was done by Valenzano. He had a fine reputation. Phelps Dodge used him for all of their development in Bisbee and at Morenci, and they were doing a lot of drilling, particularly towards the end of the 30s when the Depression was ending, and they found that they were way behind in their exploration and development and had to do something to keep abreast of operations. Jimmy did a marvelous job for them, and I know I've talked to Phelps Dodge people who had nothing but the greatest praise for his work.
Then he would make his report to you? And
yes, he would do a report to me.
His
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Of course, it doesn't compare with the quality of the drilling that we get nowadays. I noticed that particularly in recent years when Atlantic Richfield did their deep drilling in Butte, Montana, and the size of the drill cores and the high recovery of core were real examples of how drilling techniques generally have improved.
What is the size now?
Well, we used to get use an EX core, which was a 7/8 inch diameter core, and we were lucky to get 75 or 80% recovery. Nowadays, if you can judge by the results of the work in Butte, recoveries of core that measured 4 to 6 inches in diameter and ran about 100% recovery, just remarkable. Of course, the cost of that type of drilling went up astronomically too, but you did get results that could be depended upon because of those fine recovery figures.
Now, what made the difference?
Oh, I'm not enough of an expert to offer an explanation, except probably maybe better use of industrial diamonds, a better setting of bits, better casing, quality materials as much as anything. Techniques seem to me to be much the same as far as the general procedure around the drill rig is concerned, but the equipment is much better. I think that explains the better results.
Mm-hmm. So the modern geologist has a lot more information to work with.
Yes, but at a much higher price. Whether and we'll get around to that when we discuss these problems in Butte.
Okay.
Perhaps it's worth adding here, though, that in the 20s in Butte, when I was there, diamond drilling was almost verboten because of the poor results. The geological department rarely accepted results of diamond drill penetration because the core recovery was so poor, and you simply couldn't depend upon what you were looking at. Very often, if a hole was drilled and cut a vein, the alteration halo around the vein was soft granite. Perhaps the transition from very hard fresh granite to the altered zone was rather sudden, and the driller couldn't catch that change fast enough to make his adjustment in the speed of the drilling or whatever other action would be appropriate in that kind of a situation. The net result would be that the core would be lost entirely and you'd have no sample at all. And another example was the drilling that we did at Yarrington. We had great difficulty deciding on the reliability of the diamond drill results from the discovery hole at Yarrington as to whether we had an ore body or not. We knew we had some good assays, but we didn't know how much salting had occurred, and we tried to compensate for that by building a series of tanks around the drill rigs to catch every ounce of material that came out of the hole, most of it ground up sludge. And we'd assay that sludge and try to compare it, and we developed in a sort of pragmatic way formulae that we would apply to the recovery of sludge to weigh against the actual small pieces of core that were recovered in order to provide at least a judgment of what sort of material the diamond drill had penetrated. Mm. So it was not a very satisfactory exploration tool at that time. And the Anaconda management refused to accept our improvised results, which I submitted in connection with the drilling at Yarrington until a exploration shaft had been sunk and crosscuts driven and raises put up along each diamond drill hole to be sure that those holes gave us the kind of result that we had predicted. Unfortunately, our figures were pretty good. Our guesses, and that's really in a way what they were, proved to be satisfactory, and the result was that we went ahead with the Yarrington development. And I think this was also true of Phelps Dodge's developments at Morenci. There was a long delay and I know not what caused the delay. Perhaps there were many other reasons, but I know that Phelps Dodge hesitated a long time after drilling the great clay ore body at Morenci before they made the investment that makes Morenci the biggest and best producer of copper in the Phelps Dodge effort in Arizona, or in yes, in Arizona. Morenci was in Arizona.
You haven't mentioned molybdenum. Well, you mentioned it, but you
the molybdenum story I think is worth emphasizing, because it was a unique occurrence there at La Colorada ore body. Here was this rich concentration of bornite, chalcopyrite, and chalcocite, but scattered all through it were flakes of molybdenite. And as we went deeper in this breccia pipe, the molybdenite increased at a remarkably consistent rate, so that as we approached the deeper levels of the ore body, we had actually high-grade molybdenite mixed with the copper ore. When mining was started there, there was no way of technique known about ways to separate the molybdenum from the copper. And we had, I suppose, at the urging of our metallurgical department, a visit from some of the metallurgists that worked for AMAX at Climax, Colorado, and they did nothing but throw a good deal of cold water on our talk about making this molybdenum an asset. I don't know whether it was for competitive reasons or not, but at least they were professional men, and I think they were honestly telling us that copper was a detriment to a molybdenum ore body, and that you'd just better suffer along and get your copper out and not worry about the molybdenum. I know that copper, the small amount of copper that occasionally occurred at Climax was a liability in their flotation processes. However, as an indirect result of an incident that occurred there that did involve the geological department, we began to take an interest in molybdenum. We had information from underground sources that some high grading and stealing of gold was going on in our mill. And one day, Clyde Weed, the manager, called me up and said, have you any ideas about where that gold could be coming from? We hear reports that gold is being sold and that it's coming from the Colorado mine. And he said, we don't have any free gold in that ore body. And I said, well, are we sure we don't have any free gold? And he said, I don't think we do. I talked it over with my friend Roland Mulkey, and Mulkey and I, after shift, went out to the tailings dam, and we took a gold pan with us, and we started panning the tailings that were coming from the mill. And to our real delight, we found that there were strings of gold in those pans, at least a finger long, that showed that free gold was being produced at the mill, and the millmen didn't know it.
Some of them had, maybe.
Well, maybe they had. So that was of great interest. But what interested us more as geologists was the fact that here was all this beautiful blue molybdenite coming out along with the gold. Nothing else. The copper had been, the recoveries of copper were very high. There was no sign of copper in the tailings. But here was gold and here was molybdenite coming from this high-grade ore. And so we reported our findings to Clyde Weed. And he said, well, he said, you know, he said, the Climax people have told us that there's no way of getting this molybdenite out of copper ore. And we as geologists suggested just the common sense finding that the tailings were showing that these things were being separated and being produced, but not the way the Climax thinking had indicated. The molybdenite was not being recovered selectively, it was being lost selectively. Mm-hmm. So we proposed to Mr. Weed that some effort be made to just treat the tailings for molybdenum and gold. And he took very kindly to this idea and started a metallurgical program that was based on the idea that recover all the copper you could and then go after the tailings and rework the tailings to recover these accessory minerals. And the test showed that this was a very logical way to proceed and that it could be done. And the result was that they put in a molybdenum treatment plant to handle the tailings. And the net result was that Cananea became a very important producer of molybdenite. And this was a surprise to American Smelting and Refining Company, who at that time had monopolized all the molybdenum in the world, I suppose. We became a factor in molybdenum production, and later on other companies, particularly Kennecott at Bingham Canyon, which has a molybdenum credit, began to use the same general process that had been developed at Cananea to recover molybdenite from their ores. And this practice has spread through the whole copper industry. All the big porphyry coppers recover molybdenite. And they all do it not the way Climax originally started to do it, from what was essentially a molybdenite ore body, not a copper ore body. They recover the molybdenum as a byproduct of copper, and it's the principal single source of molybdenite in the world. So these were developments that were started more or less by accident at Cananea.
Well, you had something to do with it.
Well, as geologists we did. We certainly didn't as metallurgists, because we didn't know anything about metallurgy. But it was just a common sense approach that developed from the fact that somebody had been high grading gold and had done this same thing undercover, stealing from the company.
Mm-hmm. know, is there anything else we need to say about Canon AM before we...
Well, I think there's something that I'd like to say, and I'd like to say it with a good deal of caution, because it's, some of it is not only technical, but it's very hypothetical. It involves the nature of the Colorado ore body. I wrote a paper on this originally that was part of the was a contribution to the Lindgren volume put out by the AIME about 1930 or 31, and it was entitled Applied Geology at Cananea. And in it, I advanced my ideas about the genesis of this remarkable and concentration of high-grade copper within a quartz porphyry intrusive plug and in a breccia pipe. One of the things that I stressed there was the fact that in using the word applied in the title, that here was a case where you could take the kind of geology that had been developed in Butte and apply it by careful mapping to an entirely different geological environment. It meant careful, precise, accurate geological observations and the recording of those observations on note sheets, sufficient scale so that they were meaningful and useful. It started out by my mapping the whole Colorado ore body on 50 scale to the inch, which
now, was from the surface?
No, this was underground, all underground work. And I would go underground every morning and do the mapping, and then after lunch do the map posting and any other work that was required in the department. But after finishing that mapping and posting it on sections and plans, I was not satisfied that we were getting the right kind of factual data. So we started a remapping program. And we remapped the mine to see if we couldn't get closer to the truth here in finding out why this ore body was where it is. And again, we decided that we weren't getting enough information. And finally, for a third time, I remapped that entire mine on a scale of 20 feet to the inch and transposed those notes onto 50 scale maps, and then took those maps and made a series of north-south, or northerly and southerly and easterly and westerly cross-sections, so that in effect we developed a three-dimensional picture of the ore body. And for the first time it became evident how intimately related the actual contacts of the porphyry intrusive and the limits of the various segments or types of mineral assemblages in the ore body were. The result was that I developed a theory or an idea of how you could relate these associations, and I wrote that up originally in that article for the Lindgren volume. Later on, I tried to refine that in giving my Jackling lecture to the AIME. That was, of course, many years later. I'm still not entirely happy and satisfied with the conclusions I reached, and I think there's more to be done in trying to study and analyze these important relationships. But I do think that we're at a point where we can come to some valid conclusions about